The next matter on our oral calendar for argument this morning is in the matter of the appeal of the discharge of M.W. from the Minnesota Veterans Home, Minneapolis. Counsel, as you're getting situated, I'll just advise you or remind you of our rules. Each side will have 15 minutes of argument with an additional 5 minutes to relator's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. The timing restrictions are indicated in the light and clock in the lectern, which I should let you know there's a button in the front that allows you to raise or lower it to your height's convenience. And go ahead, you can go ahead and be seated now. Please state your name as you commence each leg of the argument, because we do keep track of the argument by audio recording only, and we present that to the public so that we can keep track of who's attached to which argument. Your name would be appreciated. Counsel for relator, whenever you are ready to proceed, you may.
Good morning. Stephen Schmidt from the Minnesota Legal Aid, Minnesota Disability Law Center, on behalf of relator M.W. May it please the court. For the past 2 years, the Minnesota Veterans Home in South Minneapolis has been trying to involuntarily discharge M.W., an 81-year-old veteran with Alzheimer's. The reasons that the Veterans Home is pursuing this discharge is straightforward. M.W.'s healthcare agent will not agree with the home's treatment recommendation to increase his current dosage of quetiapine, an antipsychotic medication that has not been approved by the FDA to treat behavior symptoms in patients with Alzheimer's. The Veterans Home states that the only way it can meet MW's needs is with more quetiapine, and that it must discharge him if they cannot provide this type of treatment. After a two-day hearing involving 10 witnesses and thousands of pages of documents, the administrative law judge decided that the Veterans Home could not move forward with the discharge because it did not comply with the federal regulations. Rather than accept the determination, the Department of Veterans Affairs rejected the impartial analysis of the ALJ and concluded that the home complied with state and federal law to evict MW.
Right, and the ALJ, as I understand it, did not make any determinations with respect to sort of the underlying reasons why the home was seeking to discharge the client.
Correct. There were no conclusions of law related to the Minnesota rules that for discharge. The ALJ based her decision on the federal regulations governing discharges from nursing homes.
And basically the lack of information in the notice of discharge about where the patient would be moved to, where your client would be transferred.
Yes, specifically the lack of discharge planning. The ALJ focused on the failure of the home to convey appropriate information to the proposed discharge location, White Pine Assisted Living. And that was the primary basis for her order reversing the order of discharge. So, the Department of Veterans Affairs, however, rejected this analysis and concluded that that there was compliance with state and federal law. This court, however, should reverse that decision because it's not supported by substantial evidence in view of the entire record and is affected by other errors of law. There are four principal reasons.
Can you speak a bit to the standard of review? It appears to me, anyway, that we're to give considerable deference to the agency's determination.
On the issue of viewing the substantial evidence, the standard review does speak to not substituting this court's decisions with the agency's decisions as far as inferences, as far as weighing credibility of testimony. However, courts have reversed decisions when the evidence submitted refutes by a relator refutes the evidence submitted by the agency, and that's temporary immediate suspension of child care license of Strecker, which is 777 Northwest 2nd 41.
Is there any case more clearly applicable regarding the standard of review in this context than the Hall decision of this court?
I don't believe there is. The Hall decision is one of the only, quite frankly, published decisions in the country related to involuntary discharges from nursing homes.
I mean, as I read the tone, anyway, of the opinion, it seems as if this court had some concerns about the determination that was made by the agency, but in each of the circumstances relied upon, as the court said repeatedly, this is a close case, and repeatedly said, under the narrow standard of review operative here, we're compelled to affirm. And that's the same standard we're to apply. Did you see anything wrong with it, with this court's application of the standard in that case?
No, but I think there are some significant issues and differences between, I mean, the MW's noncompliance is significantly less than JS's noncompliance. And I think it's certainly, while it is a close case, the fundamental holding of the Hall decision is that involuntary discharge needs to be last resort, and that the home needs to exhaust the treatment options available to it within the level of care that it is authorized to provide.
Well, the commissioner in this case, I mean, the agency in this case, the delegate of the commissioner, did state that standard of care here as well.
Correct, but the evidence in the record, and quite frankly, the findings of fact that the commissioner's delegate adopted shows that they did not exhaust the treatment options available to them within the level of care that they're authorized to provide, and specifically the issue of one-to-one companion care. One-to-one companion care, to be specific, is different than having one-to-one nurses come and visit you or one-to-one staff come and visit you. One-to-one companion care is having an assigned staff person be with you to, you know, help you with your behaviors.
But didn't, as I read the decision, I mean, doesn't their evidence support the determination that while there might not have been one-to-one companion care assigned, the reality is that what MW would experience, his behaviors as they're referred to, that he in fact was having people there on a one-to-one basis because of his behaviors that could go on for some period of time?
Well, I mean, the Holmes witnesses really testified that they didn't think they had to try the one-to-one companion care because they didn't think it would work.
Because they were already doing it when he was in a crisis or, you know, when he was having the behaviors, right?
Well, they weren't doing it to the extent that they were doing it with another resident, which is, they testified to, about actually assigning a person to be there with him. But I think more fundamentally, the JS by Hall decision says you have to try. You have to exhaust that treatment option before moving forward with the involuntary discharge. And that is kind of why discharge is a last resort. I think the other really important piece of the JS by Hall decision is that it recognizes that a discharge because of a refusal of treatment is not proper, citing the Minnesota Patients Bill of Rights. And in this case, if we look at the fundamental reason, there's not really a dispute that the reason for the discharge is because MW's healthcare agent won't agree to the up-titration of quetiapine.
Well, I mean, it seemed to be a combination. It was the behavior that the review committee said needed to change and wasn't changing with the other therapeutic options available.
Mm-hmm.
And so the medication was the first line up in medication, which was refused. So that seems to be, I don't know that it's accurate to say that the discharge was based entirely on a refusal for the medication. It was based upon the behavior that the medication would have, according to the staff anyway, based upon their belief and experience, would have mitigated.
Yeah, I think there's some testimony that they agreed to this up-titration to control the behaviors, they would not have gone forward with the discharge. But I understand your point that it's the behaviors. But I think that, again, the JS by Hall decision, if you read the description of the JS's behavior, it was significantly greater in noncompliance and problems than MW.
Well, maybe a little. I don't know about significantly. But, I mean, I note, again, the court says, this court noticed it's sort of disagreement that the court said, look, we find it difficult to ignore the doctor's testimony of endangerment. Nevertheless, under the narrow standard of review, we're compelled to affirm. So it seemed to be a case, if I'm reading between the lines, that this court would have affirmed in that case either for a determination of discharge or non-discharge based upon the standard of review. But this court was concerned about the behavior, but just compelled and that it had to follow, in that case, the opposite determination by the commissioner. You think I'm reading the case correctly or not?
I think that is how they reached their holding, but or the ultimate conclusion, but I do think there's really other important language in there about what it takes to discharge a resident and this issue about exhausting the treatment options of last resort. Because I think if we adopt the department's position, I think it eviscerates the protections of JS by Hall, because in practice, most of the cases aren't going to get to this level, right? So the home will not need to try different treatment options, and they can go to the ALJ at the appeal hearing and say, we don't think those options are going to work, we're not going to try them. And that's not what the decision talks about. It talks about exhausting treatment options and then going forward with discharge if those treatment options are not working.
Is it your position that every single treatment option has to be exhausted in every single case to comply with the law?
No, there's certainly limits, I think. And you know, the department's briefing seemed to adopt a reasonableness standard, and I think if this court were to adopt that, it would still need to rule in MW's favor, because one-to-one companion care is reasonable. I think these other medication options proposed by MW's outside physicians were reasonable. A walking program was reasonable. And so they needed to try these things and see if they worked, see if they helped with the behaviors, and then if not, they could have moved forward with the discharge, and they didn't do that in this case.
It seems that the agency's determination has two bases, is mm-hmm. that right? So you have, we can't meet his needs, and the other is he is an immediate threat to himself and to others. Do we have to rule in your favor on both bases in order to reverse the discharge?
Well, I think the fact that the discharge does not comply with the JS by Hall decision is enough to rule in our favor.
Well, but what if we get into just the second issue, that he's an immediate threat to himself and others?
Yes, I think those are both independent grounds for discharge, but I don't think the substantial evidence in the record, when viewed in light of the entire record, supports that he is an immediate threat.
But there is evidence in the record that he was physically aggressive with other residents. He was grabbing and kicking them. He was aggressive, verbally aggressive as well, and then physically aggressive with staff, with hitting them and attempting to hit them.
There certainly have been incidents. I think a lot of those incidents occurred early on, if you look at the dates of when he was, you know, adjusting to his new environment. But I don't think his behavior rises to that immediate threat level.
Would you agree that his behavior, at least the physical behavior, was greater than the behavior in JS? Just to refresh your recollection, if I read JS correctly, the only physical altercation was, I think, the JS had pushed another resident's wheelchair into a desk or something like that.
Yeah, I guess it's hard to say weighting them. I do think it's important to look at when those incidents occurred and the fact that no one was sent to the hospital. No one was injured as far as requiring medical attention. No one was, the police were not called. There was not an assault. I mean, I guess whether, you know, the JS, I think, discharge was more focused on the refusal of treatment issue, that she was not getting any treatment. But I don't think, looking again at the evidence in the record, and I asked the question on cross-examination, do you think he's an immediate threat? And the Veterans Home staff would not answer yes. And I think that's pretty telling. Those records are cited in my brief.
Of what significance, if any, is there to the fact that at least one other resident was moved out of the unit because of your client's behaviors and that his behaviors were disruptive of other people's health?
Well, I think the standard is an immediate threat to the health and safety of himself, other residents, or staff. And his behavior might be annoying, it might be bothersome to other residents, but that's not what the rule says as far as grounds for discharge. It needs to be this immediate threat to the health and safety of himself, other residents, or staff. And I do not believe his behavior rises to that level.
On that issue, to what extent do we defer? to the commissioner's determination on that particular issue, looking at the same facts that we're looking at?
Sure. So again, you know, recognizing that you defer to the inferences made and the weighing of the testimony, that the standard still allows this court to view the evidence in the entire record. And, you know, if the evidence that MW has submitted refuted the decision from or the evidence of the Veterans Home, the court can rule in MW's favor on that issue. And I'll just very briefly, on the federal regulation issue, you know, there's not really a dispute on that there was lack of compliance at the time of the appeal hearing. The argument from the department is essentially that they don't have to comply at the time of the appeal hearing because they said they're going to comply when the discharge is ready. And if we read the regulations in that way, it really renders them unenforceable. A nursing home could state not do a notice, not do discharge planning, not follow these rules, and then go to an ALJ and say, we'll do it after you issue your order. And
that's not the facts here. I mean, there was the first notice was deficient, and I think your argument it was deficient because it didn't identify a location to which your client would be transferred. But the subsequent amended notices all did provide that information and engage the healthcare agent in a discussion about what the better alternative placement would be, correct?
Yes. May I answer?
Yes, correct. You certainly may.
On the notice issue, yes. On the discharge planning issue, however, there was not compliance by the time of the appeal hearing. There was not sufficient information relayed to a White Pine, which is, I believe, impacted their decision on whether to accept MW. And more fundamentally, that is what the ALJ relied on in her decision to reverse the order. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kevin Jonasson, Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. The issues presented in this matter, whether substantial evidence supports the commissioner's determination to discharge MW from the home in Minneapolis, and whether the home complied with certain federal regulations applying to that discharge. The discharge reason is not straightforward. I think Judge Ross alluded to that. It's not simply a refusal to accept a treatment plan from the home. It's that the resident has been experiencing debilitating episodes on a near daily basis for multiple hours in which he is inconsolable. He's yelling, he is sobbing. The staff have no interventions at their disposal to help him out of this distress. They simply have to wait it out at the moment. They've gone through no less than 10 non-pharmacological interventions, you know, therapeutic touch, listening to music, a mechanical dog, a baby doll, a sentry blanket, magazines, listening to music, trying to talk to him about his love of the outdoors. Nothing can stop these from happening. Nothing can mitigate them once they've occurred. MW was already on quetiapine in the evening, a 37.5 milligram dose in the evening. And so I find it perplexing that the family is and the healthcare agent, I'm sorry, is so concerned about the fact that this is an off-label use of this medication. It's effective, he tolerates it well, and it is the first line and the standard of care for treatment of behaviors like MWs in individuals that have dementia. There's no evidence in the record from a qualified witness who can rebut that.
Didn't he have a negative reaction when you tried to increase the dosage of that medication?
I think that evidence comes from the family and the healthcare agent. There's no medical testimony from the nurse practitioner, the director of the medical director for the Department of Veterans Affairs, the director of nursing, or the social worker or the behavioral analyst that he was not tolerating that quetiapine well.
Was there evidence that he was tolerating it well?
There was evidence that he was tolerating it well in the evening, certainly.
With the increased dosage?
At 37.5 milligrams.
Right, but I thought there was evidence that the dosage increased and then he had a negative reaction. What you're telling me is the family and the healthcare person.
Yes, that's my understanding from the record, Your Honor.
So then is there evidence to the contrary that shows actually he was tolerating that increased dosage well?
I believe the medical staff did testify that, to my recollection at least, that when he was started on such a low dose that they had no concerns about that. And they would up-titrate it, increase it slowly until they found it to be clinically effective. And if it was not clinically effective or he was not tolerating it well, the medical director said they would simply cease its use at that time. Providers have considered other pharmacological interventions. Nudexto was suggested by the family. The home was wary of using it. The home's medical staff was wary of using it. It has, as the nurse practitioner testified, considerable side effects and more side effects than quetiapine. They did try it, and it was not effective, and it did lead to considerable side effects with MW's health, potentially fatal side effects. I know that gabapentin has been suggested by the healthcare agent as an alternative. Gabapentin is used to treat neurological pain. I think that it is used in conjunction with someone who's suffering from seizures. The home, the medical director and or the nurse practitioner testified that they did not believe in their medical opinion that neurological pain was a symptom, or not a symptom, a cause of MW's distressing behaviors. Further, the nurse practitioner testified that when a patient is on a medication that he is tolerating well, that is effective, the standard of care is not to deviate from that. It is to simply, with a 12-hour life of quetiapine, that's half a day, use quetiapine for the other half of the day, is what the nurse practitioner was testifying to.
How do you respond to the appellant's argument that the agency got this wrong because like in JS, there had not been thorough consideration and exhaustion of all of the other options to using a daytime dose of the medication?
And I think unlike JS, here the home has exhausted all of the interventions. I would argue the JS does not stand for the proposition that you have to try everything, but you have to consider it. You have to put some actual consideration into it. JS's concerns, I think, were shortcomings in care planning that facility provided. I think here the home went beyond what would be typically expected. In Exhibit 5 to the department's exhibits, there's 45 pages of observation notes noting when these episodes occur, what the episodes entail, whether it's yelling, crying, sobbing, what he is yelling. Sometimes it's nonsensical. Sometimes he's yelling, "I love you," to everyone. Sometimes he's yelling, "I love you," to no one. And these behaviors are not just simply annoying. They are extremely distressful for the staff watching them because they have run out of tools to use. And so they feel kind of helpless to help this individual.
What's the significance of the one-on-one companion care that I think seems to be one of the primary alternative supports that appellant alleges that the home should have tried, at least, not just considered, but tried?
And I think that that suggestion came from MW's healthcare agent himself. The medical testimony in this matter established from the behavioral analyst that such one-on-one companionship would not be effective, and it could actually result in triggering these behaviors because the capacity was so low, and when he would have an episode, he was receiving one-on-one companion care, de facto, essentially. It was not formally implemented, but it would occur, and it had no efficacy for mitigating those episodes.
But that's the point, I think, that opposing counsel is making, is that the one-on-one care was not part of his plan. It was being done when needed, but it wasn't an official part of his plan, and perhaps one-on-one care with people that he becomes familiar with would be something that could be effective.
Perhaps, but I think that when you look at the record before the commissioner in this case, there's no credible evidence to support that one-on-one care would be effective. That was just coming from the opinion of laypersons, stacked against the opinion of the medical staff at the home, who testified that it would not be effective.
And the basis for not being effective is that there were episodes that were occurring while one-on-one care was being provided, although it wasn't one-on-one care was not based on the plan. It was just based on the circumstances.
So a staff member would be engaging with MW by themselves, and that would often result in an episode starting because it's pretty unpredictable. It is unpredictable what will trigger these episodes. And going back to JS, I mean, JS states that, you know, discharge is a last resort. Here, the MDVA's medical director testified that we are there. The behavioral analyst testified that we are there. We've gone through no less than 10 non-pharmacological interventions without anything being consistently effective. We have one tool at our disposal, which is quetiapine, that's tolerated well in the evening, and it's effective. And the medical staff at the home believe that it would be a successful intervention if it is implemented, and certainly if it's not successful or if it has adverse side effects, it would be discontinued.
Can you explain the steps that the home took to transfer the appellant to White Pine and how that constitutes sufficient preparation?
Yes, Your Honor. Here, the home social worker contacted over 60 facilities after the determination was made that an involuntary discharge notice would be going out. A lot of those facilities actually, once they became apprised of MW's situation, declined. Some of them said that they would be able to take them on, or take MW on as a resident. The process emerged from that point of view, some of those facilities were not able to accept MW either because they either, I believe one facility just never was in contact with the home, and I believe at least one facility, there were financial issues where they would not take I think it's called a public payment waiver or something to that effect.
But I guess my question more specifically about White Pine, which is at the time of the hearing the designated facility to which MW would be transferred. What's the record that would show sufficient preparation and that White Pine understood MW's needs and was willing to and able to accept the transfer?
Yeah, yes. I believe it was April 27th of 23, the home social worker sent White Pine the medical records, I think the care plan, medication list, list of diagnoses, or at least documents that would contain these things, medical records indicating what MW's circumstances were. And at that time, it's when the discussion began of, yes, he can be accepted, and then further down the road, it was a different bed in a different unit, in the men's unit became available, and so that is the home's position, is that adequate and sufficient communication was given to White Pine before White Pine made the call that they could accept MW. I'll note that the ALJ did make a finding that it was unclear whether information from an updated care plan was provided to White Pine. Assisted living facilities under Minnesota rules can only take individuals that they can care for. And so if it does come out later that White Pine says, wait a minute, we cannot care for him, I mean, the home obviously will not be discharging him to White Pine. That effort will cease at that point unless White Pine's circumstances change or unless MW's circumstances change. And it's also noted in the record, in the summary disposition record from the declaration of the home's administrator at the time that MW is not going to be discharged anywhere but a long-term care facility that can care for him, unless that's the healthcare agent's wish. And so,
I have a question about the immediate threat.
Yes.
The agency's decision on that grounds. MW's counsel makes the point that the evidence of grabbing and kicking other residents and hitting staff, attempting to hit staff, was early at his time at the home, and that the more recent evidence doesn't demonstrate these same things, and therefore it's not immediate. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, I look at the word immediate threat as a threat that could occur any time. I don't know that there's a severity. I mean, obviously, something that is what would be a perceived threat of harm, something more.
Let me ask it a different way. What evidence is there more recent to the decision to discharge that showed he was still hitting, kicking, grabbing?
I think that there was testimony from staff from the home at the hearing that those behaviors had not been fully ceased by the time of the hearing. With that said, I think the department would acknowledge that their primary focus at the hearing for upholding the discharge was the inability to provide care needs for MW. And as far as getting back to JS, I think that the council stated that the department's kind of painting a reasonableness approach to what JS would require as far as what interventions they should try. And I think that qualifying that, it would be what is medically appropriate. I think that medical staff should have the discretion to look at an intervention and say, is this medically appropriate? For instance, with gabapentin, is it medically appropriate to do a trial run of a medication that is designed to treat the same behaviors that another medication is effective with and is tolerated well? The answer to that is no, it's not medically appropriate, and that's what the nurse practitioner testified to. I guess with that, Your Honors, I can wrap up my argument unless there's any further questioning.
Does not appear as if the panel has any further questions for you. Thank you.
I'll just conclude then very briefly. The department is very sympathetic to the experiences of families with loved ones experiencing dementia. However, the department's task in this case is incredibly difficult. They're in a very, very difficult position, and I don't mean to say that MW's healthcare agent or family is not as well. Everyone's in a difficult position in this case. But the department has to provide quality care to its residents. MW's continued stay at the home has two unfortunate consequences. He's not getting the care needs he needs as to his mental health. And the home has exhausted all of the options it has available. Second, it's limiting admissions in MW's unit, depriving other veterans of care and accommodations that they might be entitled to. And it's disrupting the activities of residents who remain in the unit. The home cannot meet MW's care needs, and the department respectfully requests that the final order of the commissioner be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for relator, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal if you'd like.
Thank you. So several points. The first, counsel describes MW's behavior in these debilitating episodes, and I would encourage your honors to watch the videos that were submitted with the record, because I do think they are the best evidence of what MW is like. There are instances of him crying, of repeating the words, "I love you," shouting, but there are also instances of him being calm and engaging with his family. And the reality is, people with Alzheimer's, their behaviors ebb and flow, and the department used, throughout the cases, used this word effective. And what does effective mean? In their view, it's sedated, right? It's zonked out, not making noise. And, the testimony from the long-term care ombudsman recognizes that, other nursing homes, they're louder. People with Alzheimer's ebb and flow, and you shouldn't be expected to be in this state of sedation, calmness, in order to receive care in a long-term care facility or a nursing home. Second, on the JS decision, the decision doesn't say consider options. It says exhaust options. That's the language of the decision. And counsel was talking about medically appropriate. We have an outside physician saying these other options might be medically appropriate. Let's try them out. I think the evidence in the record says they have not exhausted the medically appropriate options, as well as, the companion care and the walking program. There was a mention of staff distress. While that might be a case, staff distress is not one of the reasons for discharge in 9050. So that should not be a basis for a discharge, that staff feel uncomfortable with this person because he's crying. And then, on the companion care one-to-one piece, I do want to make clear that our position is that One-to-one companion care is not the same thing as one-to-one nurses coming in and treating MW. It is a specific type of treatment plan where you have one assigned staff person and they're with the person. And the behavior analyst actually testified about it with another resident who was engaging in more aggressive behavior than MW. That resident was not involuntarily discharged. Instead, they assigned the companion care. On the White Pine and the sufficient preparation orientation, White Pine, is not an appropriate. The regulations require appropriate and safe discharge location, and White Pine is not that because it is an assisted living facility with dementia care. And there's testimony in the record and that MW needs nursing facility level care. Nursing facility level of care is different than assisted living facility with dementia care. So this assertion that the home would not discharge MW to a location unless it would meet its needs, MW's position is that they are doing that by sending them to an assisted living facility with dementia care that appears not to have support for two-person assists with transfers, which is what the ALJ was concerned about. And then on the immediate threat piece, I think it's an understatement to say that the home was not focused on it. The home's briefing to the ALJ said it was the wrong standard to assess a continued stay in a footnote. It was not something that the ALJ addressed because it was really kind of a side issue at the hearing. And then the department kind of sua sponte decided that his behavior rises to that level of immediate threat. Unless there's other specific questions.
Does not appear that the panel has any other specific questions.
The ALJ wrote in her decision that if a discharge could proceed without a suitable new residence identified and planned for, vulnerable adults could find themselves discharged with no safe and appropriate place to live. And MW's position is that the court should not allow this interpretation of the regulations that would allow a discharge to proceed when there's not a safe and appropriate place to live with a facility saying, we'll find one after the hearing. That's not going to protect vulnerable adults. There will be no way to enforce the regulations, no way to make sure there's compliance. So for those reasons, because this decision is not supported by substantial evidence in view of the entire record and is affected by other errors of law, MW asks that the court issue an order reversing the decision of the Minnesota Department of Affairs. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your very thorough, comprehensive briefing in the matter. We appreciate it, and we appreciate your oral argument today. Very helpful. A difficult case, obviously legally, but there are human issues that are even more difficult. We'll deal with the legal issues and issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you. Matter is under advisement. Submitted.
Thank you.